Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What drives us to new ways of understanding the world and new solutions to our problems? While we can't always produce them on demand, insights allow us to refine and improve upon our existing goals. But as my guest today will tell us, we can create conditions for ourselves that act as fertile ground for novel perceptions and ideas. Psychologist Gary Klein is senior scientist at Macrocognition. His new book is called Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Ways We Gain Insights. Gary, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be on the show.
I would like to start by defining insight as you use it in your research. Essentially, you say that insight is a shift that we're not expecting in how we understand things.
Exactly. It comes out of the blue where sometimes we're not even working on an issue, and then all of a sudden, wow, now I see what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. So it's not the same thing, though, as an idea.
There's all kinds of ideas. There are a lot of ideas we get by just logically working through implications. A implies B, B implies C, A implies C, that sort of logical thinking. Insight doesn't follow that path. It doesn't follow any clear form of rules or anything like that. And that's why it feels so magical. It just sort of pops into our head.
What are the different kinds of insights that we can have?
Okay, that was one of the discoveries that I made when I did my research project. I identified 120 examples of insights, and then all of a sudden I found that I was sorting them into different groups. So one type of insight, most common, is a connection insight, where you learn something and then you put it together with some other things you have, and wow, now you have a new idea. An example would be Darwin looking at the different species, wondering how they evolved, and then reading Malthus about population pressure and saying that's what's driving the whole process. So getting a new piece of information and connecting it to others, that's one type, but it's not the only type. There's a second type where you make the opposite of a connection. You say, this doesn't match. Something is wrong here. Hmm. An example would be a young cop that we heard about. He's driving, his mentor is driving the car. The young cop looks up at the car in front of him. It's a new BMW, and the driver of the BMW takes a drag on a cigarette, and then flicks the ashes out onto the upholstery.
Hmm.
And the young cop looks at that and said, that doesn't make any sense. What kind of an owner would flick the ashes onto his own car? Or if you borrowed a car, if you stole a car,
yeah,
you might do that.
That's fascinating. And it's funny to imagine explaining that probable cause for pulling someone over to a judge, but it makes perfect sense when you tell the story that way.
Right. You know, it turned out to be a car theft, and it was because the cop saw something that didn't fit together, and that gave him the insight. Another example of a contradiction insight is Harry Markopoulos looking at Bernie Madoff's data about investments, and within 15 minutes of examining the publicly available data, said, this doesn't make sense. This is bogus. This can't be true. He didn't know how Madoff was pulling his fraud, but he knew it had to be fraudulent. So that's the second type, is a contradiction. And a third type that we found is really a desperation insight, where you need to get something, you need to find something out, nothing is working, and the problem is you're holding on to a belief that's flawed, and you've got to identify what that assumption is so that you can get rid of it.
So the idea of flawed beliefs is very interesting to me, because we never think we're walking around with bad information.
No, that's what makes it so insidious. And when I compared people who had insights with those who had the same information and didn't come up with an insight, sometimes the people who got the insight weren't suffering from a flawed belief, but sometimes they were. The difference seemed to be that they weren't trapped by it, that once they saw some contradictory evidence, they started to reanalyze what they knew and reanalyze their understanding of what was going on.
So the great thing about insights is that once we achieve one, it can lead to new goals. So even if we were going along and we were sort of happy with the course we'd set for ourselves, an insight can tell us time to refine this and actually sort of improve upon what had been the standard.
I think that's maybe one of the most powerful aspects of insight is to help us move to different goals than we started with. We have this idea. In a perfect world, we would identify our goals and then just chug along nicely, like businesses have Gantt charts. You know, here's my goals, here's the steps I have to take, and everything moves along nicely, and I achieve my goal, and perfect, I got just what I wanted. Insights can take us beyond perfection. They can help us see things that we didn't start out understanding and come up with a better idea. And particularly when we deal with a complex situation where the goals are not well understood at the beginning and you don't have the luxury of waiting forever to try to get them down perfectly. You say, I've got to start. This is what I think the goals are. Then you really have to depend on insights to redefine the goal on the fly.
What's interesting about that, Gary, is that many businesses these days are so risk averse that it seems like folly to begin a project without being able to predict exactly how it's going to play out.
That's their game plan. That's what they teach, especially young and middle managers. You know, here's the goals. If you don't have the goal at the start, you can go in any direction, and that's chaotic. So make sure you adhere to the goals. And these young business men and women think that the path to success is accomplishing the goals that they were given. But then as they move up in the hierarchy, they start encountering these wicked problems that don't have clear goals, and they're stuck in this mindset that I've got to achieve the goal that I was given at the start, even though those goals are inadequate and even though they may be discovering new ones.
So how much information should we try and take in with regard to a problem, hoping that it might lead to an insight?
Probably as much as you can absorb. I'm not too worried about information overload. Mm-hmm. Just looking out my window, I see lots and lots of information, different trees, you know, birds, squirrels. When we know what we're doing, we know what's important, and we can screen out the material that's not all that relevant. So I'm not too worried about information overload. That way, we run into information overload when we don't have a clear sense of where we are and what we're trying to achieve. And we particularly run into it with information technology, where we're bombarded by emails and texts and other forms of communication, and we don't have any easy way of knowing what to ignore. We've sort of got to scan everything. And I think that's what does us in.
So if information overload is not necessarily the problem, I wonder if we should also be open to breaking down the silos that exist in so many organizations. So, you know, this is your job to solve this problem. This is my job to solve this problem. And if we're not really paying attention to what the other is doing, we have no opportunity to gain insight from something that you've discovered or I've discovered.
I think that's a really important point. We don't have that opportunity, and in some cases, we're rivals. I look down the hall and I see other people in other sectors or other divisions, and I'm thinking, who's going to get the next promotion? And so I'm thinking more about my rivalry with the people inside my own organization than with my competitors.
We have an email here from Lloyd in Dallas who says, Jared Diamond in Guns, Germs, and Steel mentions the Mayans had the concept of wheels. Toys show this, but they didn't have megafauna to help them with transportation like in Eurasia. However, this ignores the fact that they did have animals over 100 pounds. They used people to move things on their backs over roads, but they didn't come up with the idea of using wheels on carts or wheelbarrows to move objects.
Right. So that's another part of this issue that fascinates me. It's not just how people get insights, but what stops people from having insights. What gets in the way? And I enjoyed Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, and I'll have to go back and look at what he wrote about that particular example, because I've spent a little time, a couple of weeks in Peru, thinking about why the civilization didn't go further. Was it the lack of money? Was it just the stratification of society? It's wonderful to speculate why insights don't happen, because once they do, it seems so obvious, but a lot of times they don't.
Yeah, that's very interesting when you and you have a number of examples in the book of people who were working on problems or questions simultaneous to having colleagues all around the world working on the same things. So why, for example, did Watson and Crick figure out the structure of DNA, or why did Charles Darwin identify evolution as a process of natural selection when there were other great minds working at the same time?
Right. So for Darwin, he read Malthus's book. He read the sixth edition. So lots of people had read the first five editions, but none of them were thinking about differences between species. So he was ripe for that kind of connection. But Charles Russell, who was also a naturalist, was in Southeast Asia and noticing species differences, and read Malthus and at just about the same time Darwin did, and came up with the same insight that this is what the pressure for survival is what drives the process. So we had two people thinking about puzzling about the same issue, the same observation: why are these species differences occurring? And then getting that extra fact about Malthus, about population pressure, and putting them together.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. You talk about concrete reasoning as a barrier to insight, and this might initially strike people as sort of counterintuitive.
I think one of the studies that I did was I compared people who had insights with others who had the same information and didn't come up with the insight, and I identified four factors that seemed to distinguish between those two groups. And one of them was a playful reasoning style that likes to speculate about things and be hypothetical, and a concrete style that looks for precedents and wants to do things in a clear and systematic way. And I think they both have their strengths. The concrete style is not a playful style. And I think it's not that we're always one or the other, but I think there seems to be some personality differences that lean more towards one or the other. So if I'm a hypothetical reasoner, I'm always going off on these flights of fancy because I'm trying to imagine different possibilities. And if I'm in a meeting with a concrete reasoner, I mean, I've been on both sides of that equation. The concrete reasoner is saying, "Will you grow up? You know, we have a job to do, and you know, you're doing this divergent thinking. You're having fun, but we've got to get stuff done."
So it sounds like organizations maybe need, ideally, are made up of a mix of both types.
Yes, I think they are, at least to start. But I suspect that the concrete thinkers, because they can be relied on, they're going to try to accomplish the original goals. They have a clearer path to success. You know, if you want to put somebody in charge of a project, I want somebody who's going to do just what he or she is asked. And so I think the more speculative types are sometimes marginalized.
My guest is psychologist Gary Klein. He is senior scientist at Macrocognition and author of the new book, Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Ways We Gain Insights. If you'd like to ask a question, maybe share how your thinking led to an insight, we would love to hear from you. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with psychologist Gary Klein, who is senior scientist at Macrocognition and author of the new book, Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Ways We Gain Insights. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. When you talk about having ample amounts of information, Gary, to be exposed to different ideas, so many of us rely on the internet these days for the vast majority of our information about the broader world. But some of the filters that are applied that are sort of good enough on Google and Yahoo and whatever other search engines we use, you think might be sort of an impediment to the broad kind of information that can lead to insights.
Right. That's coming clearer and clearer. The difficulty that we run into is when we do our own searches, we cut down the amount of accidental connections that we can make. So we're very goal-oriented. And Google and other systems are able to figure out our tendencies, and they try to help us by giving us the information we want and protecting us from the information that we haven't asked for. And as a result, we don't pick up accidental connections. We don't pick up what might seem irrelevant in some contexts but might be critical in other contexts. And so these search engines can actually work against us.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by stories of companies where the cafeteria is like the greatest generator of cool ideas because people from very different departments come together and without any particular goal in mind, discuss what they're working on, and then they go off after lunch and it all percolates and sometimes great ideas emerge.
Right, and so what they are hoping for is accidental connections, and insight, remember, is an unexpected shift, and so we're looking for these happy accidents.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Joyce in Dallas. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. You know, you guys are talking about my entire life. I started out doing a career plan with a librarian in 1969 based on economics. I was 18, mm-hmm. and I paid for college, got a degree in computers. And on that plan, I would have been a corporate person until I was 40 and become an IT manager. But because I kept researching and didn't get comfortable, which I think is the big sin, is comfort and lazy. And I kept researching, so I achieved everything on that plan by the time I was 29. So in 1979, my peers were guys in their 40s. And I didn't know that I was supposedly a superstar, but IBM recruited me. Mm-hmm. And for 10 years, I was one of the top 100 performing employees out of 300,000 because I behaved and thought differently and used their measurable quota goals to achieve things for them, but I overachieved because I did it for the customer. Like I had been a customer.
Wow, that's a great story, Joyce. Is there anything that you want to pick up on from that, Gary?
So I really like stories like that because, Joyce, you weren't following the corporate program. You had a different agenda and a different set of goals, and that instead of locking you into a program, that made you more open and more sensitive because you were thinking hard about who are my customers and what are their needs, and so that made you more responsive to their needs.
And it's interesting, too, when Joyce says she never got comfortable, which is something it's so easy to do once you feel like you've found your place in the work world, to stop looking around to see what else is out there.
That was another factor that differentiated the people who had insights and the people who didn't. The people who didn't were intelligent people, but there was a passivity to them. They were doing what they were supposed to. They were getting the work done as was expected, and so they were satisfied. And the ones who had the insight, instead of being passive, they were active. Something would happen, and they say, let me push further. I mean, Joyce talked about looking further and exploring and doing more research than she needed to. And that's the active mindset that also seems critical for insights.
What does it take, Gary, for a person with an insight to fight for getting that idea heard, that new thought heard? Because sometimes, as you write about in the book, it's just not part of the plan and it feels irrelevant, or it sidetracks a beautifully designed plan, and therefore an advocate has to really push.
That's a sad story, because an advocate can push, but can also be marginalized because they're pushing, because they see things differently, and they're going to upset the plan. An example is you have a great idea about how to change what you're doing on a project, and you want to add another task, or you want to stretch something out, and then your bosses look at you and say, Don't you realize that we're being paid, you know, based on this Gantt chart and based on our milestones, and this is going to upset everything? Why, you know, we're going to just hunker down and follow the plan, and you're going to have to be a good soldier. So there's tremendous pressure to maintain predictability, and insights are not predictable, and insights are disruptive. And so I think there's a fundamental disconnect between organizational pressures and insights. Insights are disorganizing, and so organizations claim we want insights. You know, we're eager for insights, but in fact, insights are too disruptive for most organizations. And so your question, Chris, was what do you do if you have the insight, and how hard do you press? And that's a political issue, because people who have pressed wind up being ignored. They wind up being marginalized, and you have to find the right higher level advocate and go in quietly and talk about things and try to create a groundswell. But it's not always the safe thing to do.
Do you think it's funny that you say that it's a political issue at work? Do you think this is the problem, though, with governments, that although we talk about wanting to have the best ways of doing things, we're sort of mired in tradition and in the way things have always been done, and we're not very nimble when it comes to running even a small government agency?
I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but that feels right, that a government could easily be as rigid as organizations, because if we're dealing with civil service, you don't want to do anything that's going to get in the way of your promotion or your retirement.
Right.
So that cuts down on the kind of risks you want to take. If you're dealing with elected office, you think you know your constituents, and you don't want to try for something that might be a bit daring, because that might have upset your chances for re-election. So there's a lot of pressure for risk aversion. And every now and then we read about municipalities that try something new and it's successful. And those are such inspiring stories. And we wonder, why don't those ideas get adopted more often? But they usually don't.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Martha calling from Little Rock. Hi, Martha.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. You know, there's a big segment of our, or maybe not big, but a segment of our population who are described as being intuitive. And I'm interested to know what the connection is between what we call intuition and insight, or is there not a connection? And I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
So that's another great question. And in fact, I have done some research on intuition and on intuitive decision making, and I have great respect for people like firefighters and pilots and nurses who can make decisions in just a few seconds, with too fast for rational thinking, but they have developed their intuition in their own professional area. There's not a lot of evidence that people are generally more intuitive. There may be certain types, the concrete reasoners may have trouble listening to their intuition. But the difference between intuition and insight is this. When I've worked in an area and I've built up good intuitions, my intuitions are based on my experience, the patterns. My intuitions are telling me what to do, and I can rely on those patterns. Insight is where I develop new patterns. And so insight is how I go beyond my previous experience, how I go beyond my previous understandings of things to come up with better ideas.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Rockwall and speak with Doug. Hi, Doug.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. I've got two questions for Gary. They're a little bit unrelated, but in some ways maybe they are. The first question is this. When you're under, when a country or even individuals is under intense pressure, the best example I can think of is the race to invent the atomic bomb during World War II. We didn't know how far along the Germans were. We knew they were collecting heavy water. We had enough clues to know they were on the hunt, but we weren't. We were actually scared that they would invent it before us. To what extent do you think, Gary, is this phenomenon heightened because of national pressure or pressure on an individual? In other words, does it work faster when pressure is applied to arrive at insight? The second question has to do with Leibniz and Newton. I remember in engineering school, there's a picture of both of them on opposite pages in my intro calculus book. One's in Germany, one's in England. Historians don't think they ever communicate with each other. One of them loved the elegance of mathematics. One of them required the mathematics in order to do science. Within a few months or years of each other, they both stumble upon the calculus. And I'm just wondering, do those little historical things happen very often, where you have two great minds in two different countries that happen to fall upon insight at the same time?
Terrific questions. Thanks for your call, Doug.
Yes, thank you. Okay, so we'll start with the questions in order. The first one is about stress. And this raises an issue about what's the proper state of mind to have insights. And the belief is that we want to have sort of a relaxed, open mind. We want things, we don't want any pressure, and we want to sort of get into a dreamy state and things pop into our head. But that's not always possible. And what happens when you are under this extreme pressure, like, you know, to develop an atomic bomb? That sort of contradicts all the notion of trying to be in a relaxed state of mind. There's another example of this is the famous example of Wagner Dodge in a forest fire. I think it was 1948 or 49. He had about a crew of about 15 smoke jumpers that he was leading. A fire had unexpectedly spotted or changed its course, like the, I guess the tragedy we recently had here in just a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And now the firefighters were running for their lives, and they were running uphill. It was a 76% grade, and the fire was going to beat them. They weren't going to be able to outrun it. And on the spot, he said, "I can't outrun this fire. Uphill makes it go faster, it makes me go slower, but I can create an escape fire." So he started a fire in front of him to burn out all the grass, and then he dived into the ashes. And so we see that that's just being under stress doesn't block insights from us. It really concentrates our mind wonderfully. And I think that's what happened with the Manhattan Project, where you had a team of top scientists who were under tremendous pressure, and they responded magnificently. So pressure doesn't rule out insights. It concentrates our mind. It keeps us really focused on the issue, and it creates a sense of urgency that I think is really important. And too often, we see organizations, companies that have had insights and don't have the will to act because they don't have the right kind of urgency, like Kodak getting swallowed up by digital cameras. And you say, why didn't they do anything? Well, they were the ones who invented digital cameras, but they didn't do anything because they were making so much money from film that they thought they had lots of time. So I think urgency can be a great motivator for insights. Your second issue about these kinds of coincidental discoveries, that we saw that earlier with the discovery of evolution, where you had Charles Russell Wallace and Darwin both making the same discovery at the same time, the same as Leibniz and Newton. And people have looked into these simultaneous discoveries and what kinds of conditions there were that had people ruminating about the same issues. It's not that uncommon.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Gary, who's curious about the concept of spatial data and insight, a view of where things are and patterns that might provide another perspective.
So this this raises an issue of how to display information and how to create databases that will provide us with the information we need. One of the great achievements of information technology is to create structured databases that have everything that's been collected, and then it can be presented in a systematic way in front of us and give us the information we need to do our job. And so those are wonderful developments. The problem with those developments is that sometimes when we have an insight, it changes the kind of job we want to do. And so if we're at the mercy of structured databases or at visual representations that are based on the way we've been doing our job in the past, it may make it harder for us to make the connections, see and see the patterns that are new patterns that hadn't been encountered before.
And I guess it's also true that you might see a pattern when you look at, you know, a series of bar graphs, and I might recognize a pattern if I see something that is arranged in a really different way in charts of some kind or in text. People's brains work in different ways.
They work. There are individual differences, and an example would be the Challenger accident where the O-rings failed, and the data were there about the effect of temperature on the burn patterns they got in the O-rings.
With the space shuttle, you're talking about.
With the space shuttle, right, with the space shuttle. But it took 2 weeks after the accident for them to discover how they should have graphed the data in order to see the regularity. So it depends on how we ask questions of the data. Just presenting the data in a form that's useful for everybody may make it not that useful for individuals. That can be a problem.
My guest is psychologist Gary Klein. He is senior scientist at Macrocognition. His new book is called Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Ways We Gain Insights. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Gary Klein. He's a psychologist and senior scientist at Macrocognition. He's got a new book out called Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Ways We Gain Insights. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Gary, I want to talk a little bit about the value of incubation. You tell us in the book that you will, when working on a project, you will try to look over your notes right before you head off on a long bike ride. Talk about why.
Okay. The evidence on incubation is a bit mixed. There are some people who claim that there's no scientific evidence for it. Others have found some support. I can't confidently say, yes, give yourself some time where you're not working on the problem, and that'll help you get an insight. But there's enough evidence to support it that it's worth thinking about, and whether it's superstitious or not, it feels right to me, because I'm sure lots of people have had insights when they weren't thinking about a problem, when we've been driving to the beach or we're taking a shower or just playing with kids, things just pop in our minds. So incubation might work in a couple of different ways, and it may work in several of these ways. The first thing it might do is, since you're not working on the issue, it gives these various ideas that you have floating around a chance to reconnect in different combinations. And so different associations can be formed. A second way that it can work is avoids fatigue. Whatever the fatigue that's built up as you worked on a problem, you give your mind a chance to rest and give those neural collections a chance to recover from the fatigue so that you can use them in a more fresh way. And a third possibility is it gives you a chance to experience different stimuli, different cues, different ideas that all of a sudden might spur the insight. So you've given yourself a chance for a happy accident. You're not tunneled in to the same small set of cues that you've been toiling over so long.
Yeah, and that limited set of cues maybe has put you into a groove that you need to break out of.
Right. The cues you've been looking at are based on what you think is going on. And in fact, if you have some flawed beliefs, you may be ignoring other evidence because it hasn't been relevant in the past, but it's relevant now. I would like to, during the break, I checked, and Darwin's twin was, the person who made the other discovery was Alfred Russel Wallace. I thought I had his name wrong. I wanted to correct that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Shannon in Arlington. Hello, Shannon.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious, how does an artist fit into this equation, into this discussion? We believe that artists have extra eyes and extra hearings. And in relation to this question, we believe that the artists try to make an order out of chaos. How does this fit into this discussion? By the way, Chris, I was just reading Dallas Observer, and they consider you one of the best interviewers in local Dallas film there.
Well, thank you for pointing that out, Shannon. I sure appreciate it.
Okay, so and based on this interview, I would say I would certainly go along with that.
Thank you.
So what happens for artists? And so artists are trying to gain insights about how to represent ideas, and it's not just about ideas, how to create emotions. One of the things we learned about insights is insights change the way we understand things. They also change what we do about it, how we act, and they also change what we see and how we see, and they change how we feel about things, and they change what we want, what we desire. So a number of those, I think, feed into the artistic process, changing what people see, changing how people feel. And so artists are dealing with ways of creating experiences for themselves, so they're looking for their own insights. But I think artists are also trying to create insights in the people who view or experience their works. So they're trying to shake people out of their usual way of experiencing the world. So artists are in the unique position of trying to gain insights and trying to create insights in others.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Tom in Dallas. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Chris. And thank you, Chris and Gary, for taking my call.
Sure.
The last two commenters actually feed into my question. I'm actually a local seminarian that is developing a form of counseling that uses music to help meditate on the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically take songs that artists have produced from passages of scripture to help meditate on the scriptures. And my question for Gary is, in the process, do you have an example of how to cultivate upper-level leadership? I've run into a lot of organizational inertia because it's not necessarily a new thing. It's just a new way of doing what is traditionally been called Lectio Divina in Catholic circles. Thanks, and I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks for your call, Tom.
All right, so organizations have to be very careful about where they put their energy, and they're usually feeling overwhelmed with ideas, and so there's even though organizations claim that they're seeking new ideas, I think they're generally skeptical about them, And sometimes they miss important ideas. So the issue is how to get them to be open to the ideas, how to get them to listen to what you're presenting, and how to be convincing to them about the value of what you're producing. So I'm sorry that you took your question off, that you've disappeared, because I might have a question or two for you about how you've been able to notice the benefits of the methods that you're using, and how you're going to be able to create a convincing and persuasive argument as you bring it. Because a lot of us, when we've worked on an area, we think it's a wonderful topic, but just because we've worked on it and we're committed to it. So a lot of this is how to persuade others that this is going to have the impact that we think it should.
Tom, are you still with us?
I'm still with you. As soon as you said said that, I stayed on the line. Basically, the way that I've approached it is that it actually has a biblical basis in the book of Colossians in chapter 3, and pointing back to the core identity of the organization and showing that the idea is nothing new, but it's really an old way of a new way of doing something that is core to the organization. And to what you're talking about, incubation, the way that it works, it's basically a passage of scripture that's then explained using a song that an artist has produced with the insight that they've had about that particular passage. And I encourage people to use this during commutes or their workout periods like you were talking about, and it just allows them to free their mind from the usual places where they've heard the same content but just in new ways. And the way that the artists have contributed to it, it's just amazing to see all the random connections that are finding singularities in those passages of the scriptures. And as a seminarian, I just kind of hold to that is absolute truth in helping people to connect their lives with the scriptures themselves.
That's really interesting.
Okay, so what I like about this is it appeals to people who are open to new ideas and hypothetical reasoning, but because it's based on precedent, it also would appeal to people who are concrete thinkers and appreciate going with traditions that have worked in the past. But I still think there's a burden on you to demonstrate that this can and does have an impact on audiences in order to persuade organizations to give it a try.
All right, I want to talk about this, Gary. There is, we've talked about insights in really glowing terms over the course of this hour, and certainly there have been amazing ones. Sometimes, though, they lead us to ideas, to new goals that ultimately won't succeed. That's just the way things go. How, given our desire to value insights and cultivate them, what can we do with our failures and our mistakes to allow them to help us grow?
Okay, so this goes back to the right kind of insight mindset, and whether that's going into a dreamy, relaxed state or not. And we talked about urgent situations where people are running for their lives or trying to build atomic weapons during World War II. So that's the opposite of a dreamy state. But there's an even more powerful way that shakes us out of our beliefs. And that's failures. And the problem that we run into as we become more skilled, and as we build our expertise, our understanding gets more and more effective, so we can account for more and more things. And if we run across anomalies, we become more able to explain them away, and that protects our belief system, and that keeps us stultified. So what can shake us out of that? And one of the things that shakes us out of that complacency is a failure. And some people, when they've had a failure, they just say, okay, I don't want to be discouraged. I don't want to think about it. But for other people, they just obsess about it. They say, what went wrong? And then they can't let it go until they see, okay, that's what I should have done. Okay, that was going on. I wasn't even aware of it. So failures become a tremendous opportunity for shaking us out of our prior belief system.
What is the best way for organizations to balance a tolerance for risk and for new ways of thinking with a responsibility to sort of keep the company in business, pay the shareholders, and get projects seen through to completion?
Right. That's actually what got me started on this whole project. I had this diagram that I would show audiences. I was giving presentations, and it had two arrows. There was a down arrow, and the slide that I showed was about how to improve performance. Mm-hmm. And I said, you have to do two things. The down arrow is what you have to reduce. You have to reduce errors. That's the responsibility, because errors are costly. Lives are at stake, injuries, reputation. So there's no doubt about that. The up arrow is what you have to increase, and that's insights. And you need to do both of those things. And for most organizations, they know how to reduce the errors. They know how to cut down on mistakes. They can have more strict procedures. And so they get very risk-averse and very intolerant of errors. But the activities they take to get rid of errors, if they go too far overboard, and I think many, if not most organizations, do go overboard on reducing errors, they get in the way of insights. And so your question is a perfect question, Chris. How do you create the right kind of balance? And I think organizations have to look at themselves. And I mean, I've seen so many organizations going into things like Six Sigma as a way of reducing errors, and that has its place, but too often it infects the entire organization. So the whole issue is we want to cut errors, but they don't want to just cut errors. They actually are producing things. They want to produce better products. And so they have to look at how far they've gone and if they've gotten out of balance in reducing errors and whether they need to do things to promote insights as an organization. That may be things like creating chief innovation officers that I know some organizations are going to. That may be things like creating back channels, because in an organization, if I have a new idea, it only takes one person above me in the chain of command to say, nah, that's too risky, I don't want to do it, and then nobody ever hears about it again. Hmm. So to try to prevent that kind of blockage, you can create an opportunity for like a court of appeals. I like to think of it as an oversight committee to catch these oversights and to give people a second chance so that you're not at the mercy of the weakest link in that chain.
What a wonderful idea. Yeah. So if somebody directly above you shoots down your idea, maybe they just didn't fully understand it, and you jump a notch ahead of them.
Right. If you can do it in a safe way, I think organizations could benefit. Hmm.
My guest this hour has been Gary Klein. He's a psychologist and senior scientist at Macrocognition. His new book is called Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Ways We Gain Insights. Gary, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect, and our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can send those via email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day. We'll be right back.